Get Published, Episode 20, for Sunday, December 13th, 2009. Hi there, and welcome to Get Published. I'm your host, Mike Plested. The holiday season is fast approaching, and with it, so are the demands on our time. It's getting harder and harder to find the time to write, and if that wasn't enough, I've added a new project to my dance card. I have a new podcast coming out, this time serialized fiction. The pilot episode will be dropping into the feed before December 25th, so please watch for it. This episode is a milestone for me. When I first planned on doing Get Published, I had only intended to do an episode every month. I quickly realized that I needed to be much more frequent than that, and so episode 20 has arrived a full 8 months sooner than I had expected. It's been a lot of fun talking to other writers and editors, and I'm planning to have many more interesting guests in the coming episodes. I hope that you have learned as much from these people as I have. I'm also very happy to be playing a critique of Critters, provided by one of the good friends of the show, Dan Absalonson. Look for that in the comments section of the episode. Thank you all so much for helping me to reach episode 20. I really appreciate that you take the time to listen to the show, because without you, there really wouldn't be any point to putting the podcast out. Enjoy the show.
Our lives echo across time and space, intersecting with the echoes of other lives. For every intersection, a new story is told. 10 lives are about to intersect. 10 stories are about to be told. Miranda is reaping what she has sown. Mitchell understands that there is no resisting fate. Clint dreams of forging a violent destiny. Elizabeth is about to make a discovery. Robin hides a terrible secret. Simon hasn't slept in 10 days. Sam is pursued by his nightmares. Susie is far from home. David has just been found. Jake is atoning for past evils. 10 ordinary people struggling to keep their sanity in an insane world. Emergent Publishing proudly presents Chinese Whisperings, The Red Book, a conceptual anthology of interconnected short stories from 10 emerging writers from around the world, coming soon in January 2010. For more information, check out the Chinese Whisperings website at ChineseWhisperings.com.
And now we're on to the feedback section of the show, and for this episode, Dan Absalonson sent in a critique of the website critters.org. Dan has been using Critters for the past few months to get his own work critiqued, and is providing us with his thoughts and comments on the service.
Hey Michael and Get Published listeners, this is Dan the Art Man, .blogspot.com. with a review of Critters.org. It was established in 95, about 10,000 members, and it's a great place if you're a writer to go and get your stuff critiqued. It's free. You only have to pay with time, because in order to have your writing critiqued, you must critique other people's writing. And there's kind of a point system, and you just have to pretty much do one short story a week. So, just a little bit of time, and you can get some really invaluable critiques of your own stuff done. And I would argue that critiquing other people's work has really improved my writing just as much as, you know, reading people's critiques and tightening up my story from those. It's almost like having a part-time job as an editor, and I find that while I'm specifically reading a story to try and find things wrong with it, I find a lot of stuff, and, you know, that same stuff is in my writing. And so I'm pointing things out, and then when I go back to my own writing, I catch myself doing the same things. And it's really helpful to catch myself and fix it then, and just kind of feel myself growing a little bit as a writer from critiquing other people's work. A little about the site. It's an online workshop slash critique group for serious writers of science fiction, fantasy, and horror. So it is for those specific genres, but I'm sure most of you write in those listening to this podcast anyway. It's run by Dr. Andrew Burt, who's the former vice president of SFWA, Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America, and his army of software minions, it says. So, you know, it's a really well thought out site. Everything is great. Like, if it's kind of a holiday season, you know, usually you'll have 2 weeks to get stuff in instead of one. And there's some really cool stuff on there for writers as well. There's what's called the Woohoo section. And you'll see people who've gotten stuff published. And you can see their names, what story that they had critiqued on critters.org, and where they got it published. So it's a good place to go see where writers out there are getting stuff published. And then you can go submit your stuff there. They have really cool little writerly stuff too, like survey on reading and writing habits. And if you're anything like me, you're just kind of a nerd about those things, and they really interest me, so. But enough of my rambling. They also have a special program for getting entire novels critiqued quickly. And even for short stories, here comes the power in this site. You know, if you go into a local writing group, which can be great, but you go to Critters, and instead of passing out your manuscript or whatever portions of it, you know, you drop your whole short story or part of your manuscript of your novel, and you'll get, you know, over 10 to 20, you know, it can vary, but a lot of critiques back. And these are critiques by other writers, so they're really invaluable. And, you know, you'll get the whole gamut, people that just loved your story and thought it was amazing, people that think you don't even know grammar, you know, the whole range. But I found when I submitted my first short story that a lot of people had to say the same things about what they thought was wrong with the story, and it's really helping me to look at it from a different angle and tighten things up, fix the ending. So it's been really helpful to me. Well, that's all from me, dandantheartman.blogspot.com. And thanks, Mike, for such an awesome podcast. I'm always going to stay subscribed. Seems like the snow's being pretty rough to you up there in Canada, Mike. Stay warm and keep writing. And I'll keep on listening.
Thank you for that awesome review of Critters, Dan. I use Critters as well, and I've found a lot of value in it, just like you have. And if you have any feedback, comments, questions, or reviews, you can reach me via my voicemail line at 206-203-2031. Or you can also email me at feedback@getpublishedpodcast.com. Whichever of those methods work for you, I encourage you to send me any questions, comments, or feedback you might have. And if you want to follow me on Twitter or FriendFeed or Facebook, please do so. Just mention that you've heard the Get Published podcast so I know where you're coming from. You can Twitter me at mplested or contact me via either FriendFeed or Facebook at Michael Plested. That's Michael spelled M-I-C-H-E-L-L. Whichever way you decide to contact me, let me know you've been listening, and I'd love to hear from you.
2009 was a great year for Absolute Express, the newest imprint of Hades Publications, the largest Canadian genre publisher. It was the year they officially opened the doors, accepting manuscripts in the genres of science fiction, fantasy, and horror. It's also the year the Flash Fiction Challenge was born. With two anthologies already published under the Flash Fiction Challenge banner, Absolute Express is conducting its third challenge with the theme and title of Thieves and Scoundrels. The rules are simple. The story must fit within the theme announced on the Absolute Express website. The story must be under 1,000 words, and it must be submitted by midnight Pacific Standard Time on January 15th, 2010. All the entries will be reviewed blind by a panel of judges, and the very best will be selected for publication in the next Flash Fiction Challenge anthology, due out in February or March of 2010. For more information, check out Absolute Express on the web at absolute-x-press.com.
Danger incoming interview.
I am very happy to have Linda Williams on the show today. Linda is married with three children and works by day as an educational technologist at the University of Northern BC, where she oversees an ever-changing pack of student employees in her web development lab. Linda writes science fiction set in the Okorel universe.
No, I think that's one of the challenges. If you take yourself really seriously, it's so scary to let any of the craziness of your writing world out. It was a very long time before I was even really comfortable sharing my writing. And then getting published, you know, there's a struggle with editors and the whole process of being out there and then feeling vulnerable. And I was teaching in computer science at the time at a university. And so it was like an alter ego.
Yeah, well, and being an IT person myself, I know that a lot of IT people are not terribly outgoing to start with. So the idea of sharing yourself and your writing can be a bit daunting.
Yes, yes. And you just get the edges rubbed off you a bit. And the challenge is to hang on to the dream and the feelings that you have about the writing while you're becoming a little bit more battered and yes, able to deal with the real world at the same time.
So you start out as a very much of a square peg trying to fit into a round hole, and as your edges are worn off, you fit the round hole a little better.
Maybe you get the hole a little bit worn too, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, the hard thing, I know that this podcast is for people who are looking to get published, so I do want to make sure to talk about that kind of thing and talk about you and your interests. I think the really hard thing when you're trying to get published is the horrible frustration of thinking, wow, I write better than that. How come they're published and I'm not? And you just feel like you just don't have a foot in the door to even make your case. And if you do try and make your case, it sounds like whining. And then the people that are talking about you have to do this and you have to do that, it gets so that you sound like a prima donna if you complain about it. But at the same time,
true,
it sounds like they're saying, do something impossible. Make the first sentence. The first sentence talks used to always kill me when I was trying to get published, because it would sound like people were saying, make the first sentence of your novel so exciting that it's going to be like more important to people than winning $1 million. And that's the only way you're going to get out of the slush pile. And it's got to be short and it's got to be snappy and there's got to be something fantastic happen. And you go, okay, so like I got to do the whole thing in the first sentence.
Well, and I know exactly what you mean, because I read those books too, and I heard that advice from many people as well. And so when I started writing my first novel, it took me forever. It was literally a couple of years before I even finished the first chapter, just because I would write something and look at it, and I wouldn't like it, and I'd put it aside and look at it again and think to myself, this is crap. I have to have something more grabbing, something more attention getting.
So all that focus on the first sentence, you never get the novel finished.
You never get to the second one. So it actually
Sometimes it's marketing a thing and creating it aren't necessarily the same. Like, they're related, but they're not necessarily. When I finished Throne Prize, after editing Throne Prize, I sat down to write the next book, and I just couldn't. Every time I went to write something, I just thought, well, that'll be challenged, and I'll have to explain this, and this is too wordy. And then I had, with one of the other books, a reader who really liked my work, but told me that I shouldn't be using the word that so often. And I think when Canadians are taught language, that we're more persnickety about some things, like sticking in a that. Mm-hmm. Than the Americans are, and she was American. And so I was so self-conscious. I'm still self-conscious about using that, and I'm trying to sort of stop myself doing it.
I know, I do the same thing. I have a couple of words that I have to really pay attention to. As is a word that I keep having to watch really carefully.
Then it gets like an awe counter, doesn't it? You'll go to use the word as, and you'll think, am I really using this in the right place?
Yeah.
Well, and so it inhibits you.
I made the mistake of doing a search for as in one of my chapters. And on the first page, it showed up about 40 times. And I'm thinking, Okay, that's not good. That's not good.
At the same time, if you don't just let it all out when you've got the ideas and you start worrying about the copy editing, that's really, I think for a beginner writer, if I could talk to myself when I was trying to get going, one of the things I'd say is understand the difference between being part of an editorial process and being part of a workshop.
Right.
And doing a copy edit versus doing a substantial edit. And if the copy editing mentality is in your head when you're trying to do a first draft, you're doomed.
Oh, for sure. And I think, well, I just finished Nano. I don't know if you did Nano this year or not, but
no.
NaNoWriMo, the whole point of it is try to write 50,000 words in 30 days.
Right.
And the first rule of Nano is allow yourself to write crap. And the second rule of Nano, and maybe it does precede the first, is no editing during November.
Yes. So, yeah, I think that's good because I've been part of writers' workshops that I think sometimes they can become destructive.
Yeah.
They can be wonderful, but it depends so much on the dynamic. And I think one of the reasons I wanted to do Legacies was to give people an opportunity who hadn't published before to experience an editorial process that has a destination and an endpoint. If you're part of workshops for a long time, it's this constant revision until you kind of wear away and destroy the story by trying to polish it in different directions. But if you're doing something for publication, if you've got a deadline, there's this pressure of but we want to get it finished. And so it helps give people an experience of the end-to-end that I know I didn't have when I was working on writing something that was going to be kind of the perfect thing to send off. I think workshopping and writing for submission, it can feel a little bit the same way. Because every time you get some more information, you go back and change what you've done to fit the new advice you've got. And you never get that sense of, no, there's a place at which you shouldn't be fiddling anymore. It's done.
Right. And heaven help you if you get, you know, contradicting advice at two times. You know, you change it once from the first advice, and then you get something that contradicts it. And you've already gone in and made all the changes to it. So, you know, what do you do?
So it sounds like you've had experience with that.
Oh, yeah, a little bit. So, you know, one thing let's start out with what you've actually done. What is your publishing history?
Well, in fiction, I started with a story that I sold to Circlet Press, which was an erotica press. And I had a saga that I'd been working on since I was in high school, so the Oakleral universe is a little different that way, and it was huge. It's this big iceberg, and this was the first piece of it that I published. I was a bit anxious about it because it was an erotica press, but it was a sale, and I was my professional sale, and I was too excited about that to pass it up, so I did it.
I actually had a question on my last episode. You know, do you just take your first offer because it's an offer? And I can certainly understand why, you know, the excitement and the hesitation to that.
Yeah.
But sorry to interrupt you.
No, that's okay. I mean, it's, I don't think anybody can give you advice on that except to just share their experiences to help you have more things to think about, because it is very personal.
Right.
So I did, and they asked me for an additional story, but they wanted it to be more graphic. And it's an erotica press for women. So, you know, I mean, I wasn't sort of opposed to it exactly. It wasn't that, but it really wasn't what I wanted to do. It wasn't what I wanted to be as a writer. I wanted sex to be part of what I was writing about, but I didn't want it to be, I didn't want the stories to be vehicles for sex scenes.
Right.
The sex scenes were part of the story.
Okay.
So I didn't give them anything else. And that was kind of hard to do because I thought, well, maybe this is it. And now that I have so much other stuff in print, I kind of feel that it's kind of like a male who is my main character and is a courtesan wound up being published first in Erotica Press. It's sort of appropriate. But they treated me very well. I have no complaints about Circlet. They were a good publisher to work with. And the story that I sold them got reprinted in the Best of Circlet Press later. So I actually got more money for it the second time it was published. And it's really nice to be in a best-of collection.
Yes. Yeah, that's got to be gratifying.
And after that, I really lucked out because my very good friend Allison was approached by Brian when he was getting started. She'd already published some novels unrelated to the stuff we were doing together. She was my sort of partner in writing O'Clarell stuff as a, almost, you know, how people, usually young people, not venerable people, the age we were when we got started with this, but do things together, you know, that they're coming up with ideas together, talking about it, sketching things, sending it back and forth to each other.
Right.
Sort of like happens on fanfic sites, I guess, these days. Allison and I were doing that 30 years ago, I guess it is now, when we were in university. And so she was approached by Brian, and then Brian, she said, well, I don't have anything right now that I've got finished, but I do this thing with my friend. And so she introduced me to Brian. So it's sort of cheating in a way that I got through that door.
I don't know if it's cheating or not. I think an important part of getting published is the networking element. Mm-hmm. And I think you know this as well as I do, having you're probably a more avid con goer than I am, but you meet a lot of people in a lot of different positions and situations that may actually be able to help you at some point.
Yeah, that's true. I've been feeling inadequate about how much time I spend online doing the chatting and this kind of thing and Facebook and everything else. So I'm trying to make a little more time for it in my life, because particularly today, it's really important to be a presence as a writer, whereas in the past, it was more something you did at a distance.
Right.
Today, I think everyone has a sense of involvement in everything they do. They want it to be something that that they can talk to someone about, that is a real person out there and not just this sort of one person broadcasting to the world.
Right. Well, it is definitely the whole social media aspect of it, where the writer interacts very intimately with their readers and vice versa.
But it is kind of a paradox, isn't it, for writing, because it is the ultimately solitary art. So how do you feel about that? Like, do you, you got into this because you were interested in meeting people and having a way of interacting with writers, and you are a writer and you're looking to get published and everything else. Do you find that sort of gets confusing at times or not?
No, not so much. I mean, when I first started writing, I definitely had that feeling that writing was a solitary endeavor. It was something that you did with your laptop or your computer or your typewriter, depending on the age of you know, when you were creating things. But I learned during my first NaNoWriMo in 2006 that writing is really not a solitary thing at all. It's more of a community effort. So if you're writing nonfiction, chances are quite good that you're going into a library or somewhere to do reference work and you're interacting mm-hmm. with people there. When you're writing fiction, as you were saying, you know, you're bouncing ideas off of people. When I got into, or when I decided I wanted to do podcasting, I had been blogging, I think, on a writing site for a couple of years. And the comments that came back, the feedback we got from our blogs, really got me introduced into that two-way communication.
Mm-hmm.
So not really confusing for me. In fact, I think an author needs a platform, and this is a great way to start involving people in your work and your ideas and helping them to get a connection to you and help you build your platform.
Yeah, no, I think we each have to do it in our own way. I had a like the Legacies line is one of the ways that I wanted to engage a community. I used to publish something called Reflections on Water, where I was just the producer of an online journal, and I was working with writers and artists in Northern BC at the time to be the content for that. So it was like I wasn't part of the content.
Right.
And that was a way that I wanted to give back. So I've all sort of felt intrinsically that there is, And it was confusing for me when I started, because I think I started as a professional writer at the point where professional writers were beginning to feel very threatened by the internet. Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot of very negative conversations about pod people and, you know, you do this and you're dead, you'll never be a pro again. And there still is some of that, you know, my publisher's bigger than your publisher and I make this much money, how much do you make and how many copies have you sold? And that's sort of like the Velveteen Rabbit thing, how real are you? Yeah. And so there are still people that try to create that separation between the great unwashed wannabes and the real writers. But I think it's not as sort of taken for granted as it used to be that's right or normal. And I think that's a good thing in a way. I mean, I think if people aren't wanting to be writers and if people are not writing, then they're not going to be reading either. And I sure read a lot. Yeah. And I like writing, working with writers and talking to writers. And I like to be able to talk to them about the joy of writing as well as just what I'm writing. So it just kind of get down off your off your high horse or the internet fuzzies up a lot of barriers.
It really does. And I know I've heard a lot of the comments that you just cited. You know, if you podcast your book, then don't ever expect to sell it. Mm-hmm. And I know a number of podcasters who have done exactly that, podcast their book, grown a huge audience. And that is the reason why they sold that book. Not mm-hmm. in spite of it, but because of it.
Yeah, no, the rules are changing. They and are. Really, it's whatever you can get away with.
No, very true. You know,
I thought at one point about putting my stuff on the web because economically publishing books is a very big challenge these days. The distribution's expensive. There's lots of ways to get written material. So it is tough. And so I did think about that at one point because my goal is really, yeah, sure, I'd love to make enough money at writing to be able to retire early and write more books or something. But ultimately, I want my characters, my stories, my themes, my issues, my the Yokoval universe and all the people that have connected with it in addition to me, I want it all to sort of get launched into the world. And if that could be done in a way that didn't involve traditional publishing model, I would have done it totally.
Right.
I just decided that it was the best at the time that I was getting started. It was the only way you could be taken seriously. And I don't think that's quite as true as it used to be.
No, I think you're right. And you looking at the old model, you know, if your publisher was big enough to have a marketing promotional budget, then the word about your book got out, your book saw the shelves, it might even have gotten put onto the front shelf, you know, facing out. But those kind of budgetary dollars just don't exist anymore for most presses. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what do? You have to reach your audience somehow, and I think that's really where the internet is showing its power.
Yeah. But and it doesn't matter. I mean, ultimately, how many people do you need to read your book, I guess, is the ultimate question, because I remember once thinking before I'd been published, I loved it so much, it meant so much to me, and I put so much of myself into it all. And I thought, if only 100 people, if I can get 100 people in the world to read my books, I will be happy. That will be enough. That will be enough to make me feel it's all been worthwhile. Right. And I remember sort of thinking that as sort of like a deal with the devil. Mm. Just let me have this. I'll be okay. And you know, when you've got that, then you're just wanting more and more all the time. I think we're just sort of all, my daughter who writes too and is looking for a publisher, as I said, you get greedy. You want more readers. But I think if people know what they're in it for, I think it's a wonderful, wonderful thing to do to write and great, great creative joy.
No, for sure. I totally agree with you. I mean, if you go into it with aspirations of grandeur, you may be setting yourself up for failure. But if you're doing it for the creativity and for the love of writing, really, as your two prime motivators, that will take you a long ways.
It'll keep you from burning out people who quit quickly. are the ones that are just figuring, well, they're going to be a success overnight and they're going to make $1 million. Well, yeah, right.
Yeah, that's where the posthumous part comes in. You know,
Yeah. you can still die hoping, right?
Yeah, exactly. Now, you've mentioned Ocarel a few times. You want to tell us a little bit about the universe and the various series that you have going in Ocarel?
There's two series. The saga is the story set 1,000 years in the future of a culture clash between two different branches of humanity, basically. And it's an arena that I play out through characters that are central to it. And I put them in situations and dilemmas that answer the questions that troubled me in my youth. And now towards the end of the saga, the things that trouble and interest me in my old age, not old age, I'm 50, but 51, I'm not ancient yet. But, you know, as I'm more mature, some of my characters have matured, but at the same time, I have a younger readership than I expected. And so I'm finding some of my young readers, I know through them, my daughters, and so they're having an influence too. So now that we're getting to the end of the saga, there's this sort of schizophrenic thing going on where some of it is my sort of jaded older perspective that is getting worked through the characters' dilemmas. But there's also this sort of rising tide of the of the younger crowd. So I never know when people ask me whether to describe it in terms of the themes, its creative history, or its characters. But the bigger, I guess the quickest way to do the big picture with the theme is just that one of them was, how do we survive in a universe where we have cultural differences and we have competitive interests, but we also have the power to destroy all life in the universe through technology and science? And so I work with the cultural systems that constrain those kind of destructive behaviors. And of course, I've invented these cultural systems that are opposed to one another intrinsically, some based on religion, some based on transparent society, different variations of religion. That's sort of the fight, the battleground. But I do it through characters. It's all very character-driven.
Right. And you have several books in the series. It's not like it's a series of one or two books, is it?
No, there's five books in print in the saga, and the sixth is coming out in April.
Okay.
This year. And I have a contract with Brian for 10. And it's always been planned as 10, which was one of my challenges. I always wanted it to be a 10-novel series. It was always this big thing I'd been plotting and scheming and devising and knitting together for decades. And so I couldn't just chunk it up into little hunks that were going to be the right market-sized tidbits for kibble this week.
Right.
About, you know, vampire lust or whatever it is that's wanted. So I really felt at one point that it was all quite hopeless and that's when I was thinking about putting it on the internet. Because I just thought, well, you know, it's never going to fit into the flavor of the day marketing strategy because of the nature of it.
Right.
And in addition to the 10-novel series, I have written over the years all kinds of bits and pieces. And so some of those have found their ways into novellas by me. And some of them are on the web. I have an extensive website. If you Google Linda Williams with a Y, Linda, L-Y-N-D-A Williams, or Ocarel, you'll find it. And there's tons of stuff on there. And I also do anthologies of short stories written by other people that are into the series. So people who are either interested in getting a professional sale and willing to learn the series in order to sell something to me, or people that are genuinely just, I love this, what happened to so-and-so, and I get to the place where I go, you know what, I got a 10-novel series to finish here, so if you want to know what happened to so-and-so, you're going to have to write that. And that's really how the anthologies got going. And I've had one novella written by another professional writer, Craig Woolsby, who is my advisor for the fencing, as one of the ways that one of the cultures, it's a big universe, solve their problem about how to not blow up the universe if we've got the power to do it, is they have a sort of a politically a pseudo-feudal system, and they settle their conflicts that we would settle in court. Rather than going to war, you have to have a duel, and you have rules around who's allowed to duel. It has to be somebody who's a member of the family. It can't just be a ringer. So I had a fencing advisor who was a professional fencer who could tell me that my scenes were good or bad or whatever. So he got interested and did a novella.
Excellent. Yeah, that sounds like an interesting thing. Every family will have their one fencer that for every generation, just so they have their own built-in ringer.
That's right. But then you're also taking the risk that you're going to lose your son or your uncle.
Right.
And so you have to be quite serious about it if it's a life and death duel. But then different cultures have different, like the Demish would very rarely fight a life and death duel, but they would fight a first blood duel more commonly than whereas the Vrelish tend to be, all right, we're going to do this. Let's do it right now. The Demish would take a year in court to decide whether they were going to fight a duel, whereas the Vrelish would be, okay, I want this over by lunch.
Yeah, they're a little more hot-headed then.
Yes, they are. And the Sevelites, those are all Sevelite types of characters, and they're all bioengineered, so I'd taken certain characteristics and blown them up a little bit, and they're all designed to be pilots, and to be a pilot in the Okolval universe, you have to have a kind of larger-than-life personality. You've got to have what's called grip, which means an intense connection to the here and now. So,
excellent. So in your universe, you have filled the role of the author and of the editor as well, haven't you?
Mm-hmm. So I'm the integrity editor and the production manager for the Legacy series, and I have a relationship with my publisher, Brian. I started with the Legacy series with Windstorm Creative in the States, and the first handful of books came out through them. And again, they were very good people. It was just too difficult to get the books printed there and across the border, and the cost for them was stacking up so that they were harder to sell. And they didn't have the distribution network Brian did either, so I pretty much had to do all the distribution myself. And when I found that I just couldn't do that anymore, they had always been very upfront with me about respecting authors' rights, and particularly about the fact that this was a lifelong investment for me. It wasn't just, you know, I'll try this and pitch it, and if it doesn't work, I'll try something else. Mm-hmm. This was something I'd been doing since I was a high school student, and so I couldn't afford to get it tangled up in legalities that I would be basically screwed if I signed something. So they promised me at the beginning that if it didn't work out, they would respect my rights as an author and let me go. And they did. So I have nothing but good things to say about them. They're very good to their authors. They didn't have, I just couldn't work with them for practical reasons, the way things were evolving, but they stuck to their guns, and they had good integrity in their dealings with me.
Right. Yeah, I think being able to trust your publisher and your editor and your agent are probably pretty critical to a writer.
Yeah, and I still don't have an agent, and I never really gone looking for one. One of the questions, I think, if I ever get the Okolval universe finished will be, do I still want to write? And if so, do I want an agent? Because I've learned an awful lot more than I used to know about how the industry works, and a lot of things that I really was a babe in the woods about before that I don't even know. So I think I've got to just wait and see. 2 years, I'll be done in 2 years.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, I think you've been fairly busy for the last while, so you can be forgiven for not having an agent, if there was anything to forgive.
Yeah, but, you know, it is, if you're going to be, like, my daughter's looking for an agent, and she's just sold her first story to On Spec, Jennifer Lott.
Yeah.
Not On Spec. Oh, slap my wrists. Neoopsis. Sorry, Carl.
Okay, Neoopsis.
And she did that all on her own. I don't even think they knew she was my daughter when they were looking at stuff, because she didn't, you know. So yeah, she's just sold her first story, and she wants an agent. She wants to do the professional route, you know, in a way that's sort of very committed to wanting to make it more of a central part of her life plan.
Right.
So we'll see how that goes. It's just so hard. One of the things I found hard there in particular is I realized at one point that I really couldn't help her. My connections might have been meaningful if she was doing something different than exactly what she wanted to do.
Yeah.
But I could help her in some ways, but in others I just couldn't. Like, I couldn't flip a switch and make and give her what she needed.
Yeah.
To make her dreams come true. Well, that's a really hard thing. Like, you must get people asking you all the time how to get published, since that's what your podcast is about.
Right.
So how do you respond to that?
Well, I think what I have to say about that is there's two things that you have to have. One of them is persistence and one is perseverance, and they're more or less the same. Mm-hmm. But it's all in how you approach it. You know, don't give up at the first sign of trouble. It is not going to be a quick win, typically, unless you're very, very lucky. And so what you need to do is learn as much about the industry as you can and keep plugging away. And I mean, I'm not published yet, so I'm still plugging away myself, which is one of the reasons why I actually started the show, was so I could learn where my deficiencies of knowledge happen to be, just to improve my chances of success going down the road.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great novel way to to do it. That's great. I mean, everybody's road's different. And it was many, many years that I really can relate to people who are wanting to get published and want it so badly. You can just feel it. And you go through all this angst of what if this and what if that, and what'll I do if I never do, and when will I do this, and how long do I wait for this to come back? And it's really is tough. It really is tough. I think I still do it myself sometimes too. I mean, there have been times in my life when I've got really, really busy, just sort of treading water in life. And I think, why am I spending all this time writing novels and doing things? I mean, if I'm just looking at it from the balance sheet point of view, although I am now making money on my novels, it's not like I could give up my job as an administrator with a college.
Right. Yeah.
and expect to have the same paycheck by any stretch of the imagination. So it never ends, that sort of angst about why am I doing this and am I still a writer? But I always just felt that being a writer was the coolest thing anybody could ever be.
No, I agree with you. I feel the same way.
So how did you get to that feeling? You're in IT. I was in IT. Techies aren't... How did you get to the writing is the coolest thing to be?
I don't know. I always used to write when I was in junior high and high school, so... I kind of lost the writing bug. I shouldn't say that. I kind of had to put writing on an indefinite hiatus when I went to college, just because I didn't have time to do my schoolwork and write and read and work so that I could pay for school. So again, like you said, life kind of gets in the way. Mm-hmm. And so the writing kind of went to the wayside for a while. And at one point,
and you hit a place in your life when you said, no, I want this back.
Well, yeah. For me, I kind of realized something was missing. You know, I had a family, and that was one of my priorities in life. But even with the family, there felt there was a gap. And when I really did some introspection, I realized that the hole was the fact that I wasn't writing.
Interesting. So I have a kind of feeling that some writers are born, you know that you're a writer, and all the emphasis these days on it's heartbreaking sometimes how little writers are respected. Like writers in film and video and stuff very often get almost no billing. You know, you feel like you just dime a dozen, they can be replaced like tissue paper for TV in particular. And yet so much of what's really important about our worldview has been shaped by great writers of the past, and even not the great ones, but just the people that picked up a theme and did something really entertaining with it, and captured the imagination from which movies were made and everything else. And yet it's really a devalued art these days, it seems to me.
Yeah, it certainly seems that way. And I think maybe part of that is you look at television and you look at movies, and it's a visual medium. And granted, writing is definitely visual in that you have to read it, but you have to visualize in your mind when you're reading, as opposed to having those pictures thrust upon you on the screen.
And I think exactly, you create the theater in your head.
Right.
And I was thinking about that the other day. I was so encouraged when I realized young people were reading my books, and my daughters were reading my books, and they were talking to me about my books, and their friends, and it was just, I had this revelation that it's not all over. The same people who are spending all their days on the internet looking at YouTube videos and are primarily watching TV, they're the same people that are on there writing fanfic and are reading books, reading my books, reading Harry Potter, you know, whatever it is. That it's not like these things are mutually exclusive. And then I started thinking about some of the advice I'd got, which may be germane to some of your listeners, because you get that sort of ooby visual, have a car chase, someone's got to be murdered in the first 10 seconds, get in all the smells and sounds and sights and everything right away. And I thought, just a minute, is some of that advice actually pushing writers in the direction of thinking about being really good screenplay writers or something, or like trying to turn writing into a visual medium, when actually the very kids that love and watch visual stuff all the time are telling me what they like about my books is that you're in the characters' heads. You know what's going on with them psychologically. You get to see different things happen from multiple points of view. You've got conversation. You've got dialogue in which people's tensions and desires and conflicts is playing out. And although you can have dialogue in a movie, it's always struggling to emerge from the visual. And you can't get into people's heads in quite the same way. And their perspective, because their perspective colors everything. You can do perspective things in TV. I mean, we could have lengthy arguments about that, but I guess what I'm getting at is, why should we as writers always just bow to the superiority of visual and try to make our books bad movies instead of making them great books?
Well, and quite frankly, we can do things in our writing that no special effects house can match at this point. Maybe one day.
And even if they could, it might cost them $100,000. It costs us, you know, cost for a piece of paper.
Exactly. We can have a special effects extravaganza on every page that would break the budget of most movies.
So do you find yourself thinking of how something might play in a movie when you're writing it?
You know, I don't usually. I really don't see my books in movie form, but I tend to be fairly character driven in my writing. So I'm looking at it from how does it appear through the character's eyes? Know, how do they see it? How are they experiencing it, as opposed to how would it look on a screen?
Which is always that big third party perspective.
Right.
Another thing I've experienced is the video game thing. I went to a conference in Oxford, actually. I presented a paper on my creative process. The people there were all talking about video, live building environments, virtual environments people would go into and experience ancient Rome or whatever, and simulations and everything. And I was working in e-learning at the time, and I had done that previously, so I was sensitized to all these things. But I was really shocked to hear some of these very intelligent people saying that once the simulation world gets good enough, nobody would want to read a book again. Nobody would want a narrative that was planned in advance if they could personally immerse themselves in a world and live it themselves. And to me, that's like saying, you know, if people learn how to play instruments and they can go into a room and jam, why would they ever want to listen to Mozart or anything that was planned? Right. I mean, the difference between wandering into a game and solving it and following a narrative from the point of view of an author, as opposed to just the multiple alternate endings kind of wander through this environment and do whatever you like sort of scenario. I mean, when a writer is producing a book, they're, like you say, doing it from a point of view that is a symphony of meaning. Mm-hmm. And it's not just a random going. It's like saying if you could transport somebody back in time to the time of Jane Austen when she was writing Pride and Prejudice, and you plunk them in a family like Elizabeth Bennet's, would you have Pride and Prejudice? No, you'd have a woman living in a family.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and it was amazing because I realized when these people were talking that way, that they were completely blind to all of the richness of novels that I perceived when I read them. To them, they were just really lousy simulations in which they didn't get to grab the joystick.
Oh.
Bloop, lady.
I guess we don't have to worry about them being our readership then.
No, probably not.
But that's okay. There's a lot of people out there who like to exercise their imaginations and see things through multiple eyes and actually experience the story.
So you said that you like character-driven stories. What does that mean to you?
What does that mean to me? Basically, you know, when I start looking at, before I even start writing a story, I usually have characters in my mind and I kind of know who they are. I kind of know how they're going to react. So I start thinking about where I can put them that would be interesting for those people and how they interact with their world and the people who live there. That's where I see the character driven. I mean, they are, the story is really revolving around how they're experiencing everything and how they're reacting to it.
I often get asked how much of my character's response to their environment is, or my character's life experience, like what you're saying, is biographical. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. What do you think? Can you write about something that isn't personal?
I think you can. I know one of my main protagonists in the first book I ever wrote started out very much like me. And through multiple iterations of editing, he has become something else. But I've also written, there's a secondary protagonist who is a woman, and I definitely don't have any frame of reference for that. But, you know, I try to think about how people are going to react to certain stimuli, and I do a lot of people watching, so I kind of see how people are, especially people I know, how they react to things. So I use that a lot of that as well, not just my own personal experience.
Yeah, because I mean, in theory, then you couldn't write women, I couldn't write men. I've been called on, why are most of my main characters male? I thought about that. And I think maybe it's my generation, maybe it's something bigger than that. But at some level, I think I wanted to write men because men are more attention grabbing, at some level in some ways. So not all my characters are male. There's lots of important and strong female characters, but I think character-wise, if people said to me, you know, like, what characters is the Okawa universe about? A male is the main character, and he's a guy. And then Horth is another important main character, and he's a guy. So, yeah, it's funny, isn't it? I mean, does that mean...
I come from the other side of things. My most favorite writer growing up, and still she's one of my favorite authors, is Anne McCaffrey.
Uh-huh.
And Anne McCaffrey writes extremely strong female protagonists.
Right.
Very strong. So, you know, I try to write my characters to do justice to what she's done. So, you know, in her Crystal Singer series, there's Killashandra, and then there's Minnelli from the part of her Pern series. And
mm-hmm.
Yeah, I certainly don't have the experience of being a female, but I have seen very well written, strong female
characters. Yeah. And reading gives you, I mean, most of the characters I read about as a young person were male. So maybe that's part of what's influenced me. I mean, I do have female characters. But I always like to, I think sometimes with a female character too, or any character that's sort of been traditionally viewed as an underdog, you have this, like, they have to be strong. Mm-hmm. And I don't necessarily always want to write characters that are exemplary in all ways. All my characters have some kind of problem, flaw, places in which they don't behave optimally. And my heroes are always a bit messed up in some fashion or another. And I just find it gets them into so much more trouble. And I do want the reader to be going at times, no, no, you idiot, don't do that. Or, I just want to hit you.
Well, and I mean, I agree. If you're going to write a protagonist or any character, whether they're good or bad, they need to have some weaknesses and flaws. because
in fact, I think that's probably a problem that a lot of beginning writers trying to think again about the, a lot of people who've come to me and said, I'm writing and I'm doing this and this is what my character is and she's amazing. She's had this horrible life, but she's really strong and she can beat everybody up with one hand tied behind her back and she's really brilliant and she's beautiful, and they keep going on and I go, okay, what problems has she got? Yeah. Oh, well, she's fighting this really bad guy. Yeah, but she can beat him up, right? Oh, yeah, and she loves this guy. Okay, but, you know, she's really beautiful and he likes her, doesn't he? Well, yeah. So has she got any problems? Like, without conflict in a story, you can't have a story. And I think that's something that's really hard, particularly when you like characters. Or you're kind of living out, because all characters have to engage the reader enough to make the reader want to go along for the ride. So they have to feel a desire to connect with them because there's something about that character that's exciting. At the same time, making sure that the character is going to be human enough to be in trouble.
Yeah. Well, and how can you relate with someone who's perfect? I'm not perfect. I have no idea what that's like. Mm-hmm. And reading a character that's perfect isn't real to me.
But you do get that in soap operas. Like, you'll get the character who's only problem is that she's just too kind to be true. And well, I mean, that I do that with a male to some extent and it gets him in trouble, but he does learn after about five books. You can do that, but at the same time, I do have little bits and pieces where he likes luxury and things of that kind. So you do have some less than perfect things about them, or else the perfection itself becomes a problem. Becomes an irritation, becomes something that people will pick on you for because you're too pretty or something. Right. But there's like in soap operas where there's these like super wonderful people that you just don't believe in, or else like this, sometimes the characters are so high maintenance. You're just going, you know what, you idiot, he loves you. If you don't see that and you need more proof, I think you really need a psychiatrist. So I want the problem to be real.
Yeah.
I want it to be real enough that I think two people might be able to argue the rights and the wrongs of it if they came from different perspectives, and not just being a case of once everybody knows all the facts, it'll be obvious to everyone what the answer is.
Right. So you have mentioned that you've opened your universe up to other writers. What kind of things do you look for when you're allowing someone to write in O'Carell universe?
I think almost every kind of publication has a catch. And if you don't have a catch, then no one will believe you. So I've thought a lot about that. And I think mine is that you have to buy into my universe. You have to want to write in my universe. And a lot of people just don't want to do that. They want to do what they want to do. And if they're going to write in somebody else's universe, they want it to be Star Wars and they want to be paid $50,000 for it or something. So I think, first of all, people have to have bought into my universe enough that they're willing to work within the parameters. Then what I do is I do it on a basis of sign up. So if somebody says, you know what, I want to write this story set in your universe and I want it to be in Anthology 6, that's a possibility. I start working with them at that point and I say, okay, you got to accept the fact that's not going to be out for so many years. You have to give me a summary of what it's going to be, and then we can go back and forth with one another and agree on, yeah, you can do that in my universe. You can run with it. I usually encourage people to pick something that they identify with, the story they want to tell, and then I'll help them find a place to set it. But they do have to have the right trappings. They can't break the major rules of the universe, but inside those parameters of 1,000 years of time and, you know, at least 20 different cultures and periods of history are abound, if they can find something they want to do, then I will sign them up. And then they only lose their spot if they don't meet deadlines and they don't play ball as we go along. At some point I'll go, you know what, this is going to the next stage and I haven't got something from you that we needed in a timely way, so I'm going to ask someone else if they want to step in and take over your spot. So that's the way I do it. It's sort of an unusual way, but I don't want to make people do a lot of work and work with me on it if they're not going to get the publication. So I'm not yet at the place where I can just go, you know, yeah, go write me a story and send it to me. And I'm so famous that zillions of people will want to do that. And So it's sort of an open door in that sense, but there is a catch in that it's work. It's $30 for a story. It's published in a legacy series with the anthology. For things like Craig, it's a lot more work to do a novella. And usually it's people that have already done a short story. I have one other person working on a novella right now. So it's really as it arises. People that like my work enough to get involved with it and sign up with me and wanting to do something, and then can put up with going through two rounds of editing, the integrity edit of the plot, where I'm saying, yes, you can or no, you can't do that. Mm-hmm. And working with me on it like a conversation. And then the next aspect is that, particularly with the legacy series for the anthologies just now, it's been deathly slow. I'm working on 4 and 5 and getting them done by Christmas or over Christmas holidays, if nothing else. But there was a big hiatus there because I changed jobs. And so for a few months, I was completely out of it. And then I had to finish Avim's Oath, which took up what time I wasn't spending on changing jobs. Right. So it's a hurry up and wait situation, but it is an open door if there is somebody who really just wants the experience and is willing to work with me on it and is capable. I mean, I have had people who've submitted work to me that I just can't, it's not good writing. Mm-hmm. And they're not interested in negotiating. And then there was somebody who wanted to do a story for one of the anthologies that was going to completely invalidate the whole 10-novel series. he said, I'll tell you what, how about if I write this story that proves that 1,000 years of history in the Okawa universe has actually all been driven by a secret society run by the Goro Elpal? And I get, well, not so much. No, sorry.
Yeah, you don't want to compromise the integrity of your universe for a single story.
Yeah, but within that scope, I have had people do short stories that are now introduced characters that are mentioned in the saga books, not as main characters, but as part of the tapestry behind the rest of everything.
Right.
And like with Craig, he did write a story about a main character, Horth, because he had worked with Horth in Righteous Anger as my fencing expert.
Got it. And so what kind of things do you do to promote the universe?
Well, it depends. I go to cons. I write a column in Cutbanks magazine in Prince George called From Another Universe, in which I connect the Okawa universe with just about everything, from religion to cultural festivals to language. I send books. I do what I call soul touching. So if there's a con going on I can't get to, but for some reason I've heard about it or I've got a contact and I think it's kind of cool, I'll send them a package of books and say, here's the drugs, get hooked. And people have been really surprisingly happy about that. These days it seems like everybody's giving away books, so you wonder whether that's taking Coles to Newcastle or not, but it's been well received. I will go and talk to writers' groups. I will do presentations. I do launches. I have had pandemic tournaments. If you look on YouTube, for example, there's things from launches that I've done where Steph, who's a friend, will do videos for me and put them on YouTube. And that gives people a flavor of an Okawa launch where people are showing up in costumes of the characters and they'll come and do like the pandemic tournament. I actually have fencing tournament with foam swords. So that's attractive to the younger people. I've been working on book clubs. I'm going to do that in January. I've got some discussion questions for Far Arena, which is book 5 of the series. And I'm going to do them for books 1, 2, 3, and 4 and book 6 as well, which is out in April. And I'm going to try and work with book clubs next. So basically anything I can come up with. I've also got buttons. A friend of mine makes me buttons for the Okawa universe. So every time there's a new book, I have quotes from the book and from some previous ones that people have said, oh, you got to have this. This has got to be on one. And so we do up those books. And one of my younger readers has done some chibi characters, they're called, for the characters. And so I've got some buttons that have got those pictures on them. I have another one that was some art that had been donated to me. I buy some art for the website and others donated. And pretty much anything anybody says about the Okawa universe, if they want to do something creative relating to it,
yeah,
I'll stick that on my website.
Excellent. And you've talked about the website. Where can my listeners find you?
Easiest way is to Google for either OKALREL, which is the surefire way, OKAL space REL, or to Google for Linda Williams. It's Linda with a Y. And depends on which day of the week. I'm usually the top hit or the second or third hit for Linda Williams. The website's actually www.okalrel.org. I also have a Facebook presence. I have a OKALREL Universe page on Facebook, which is a kind of awkward beast because I'm not quite sure how to make it interactive. It seems a little stilted.
Yeah.
But if people sign up to that, I will at least try and say hi to them. When I get to them in the list, I'll put something on their homepage to say, hi, thanks for signing up, and maybe strike up a conversation that way. Or on Facebook, I've got just my personal Linda Williams on Facebook. People are welcome to talk to me there or to send me an email if they want to talk to me about, like, if one of your listeners is interested in writing for the sixth anthology or exploring a novella, which is quite a big commitment. I'm always willing to talk to people. It's starting to pick up the OKALREL Universe, so like it's only been like a year and a half, so two years that I've been in the black. So at this point, it's still not, I mean, it's still quite possible for me to chat with people that I get to know at a con or that contact me by email and go from that to working up a story with them. So I'm really happy to be in a position where I'm hoping that two or three years from now, it'll be people submitting things and I'll be able to just go, yeah, I want that one. I don't want that one. I'll be able to be like those evil editors.
Ah, very good.
But it's still pretty homey and cozy at the moment.
That's great. Well, thank you very much, Linda, for taking time to talk to me today. I really appreciate it. And I think the listeners are going to get a lot out of this discussion.
Well, and thank you, listeners, for listening. I think that I wish you all the best in your writing, whatever it is. And I know how tough it is, and everybody who's succeeded has been where you are right now, and everybody who's succeeded is still now looking at somebody else and thinking, how do I get there? So you're just on the same path, you're just in a different place, and if you want to badly enough, like Mike said, it's persistence, and writers are very cool things to be.
Very true.
Why is it that you persist in saving the humans, Elena? Is it love? Is it nostalgia for what we once were? What purpose could you possibly have that could not be better served by a heart of gears and steam?
Jonathan Andrews thought that his life was turned upside down when he joined a secret society of wizards, but he had no idea what was in store for him. Join Jonathan and the others as they delve through the mystery that threatens all life on the planet. Listen to the free podcast at thegearheart.com.
And that's our show. If you'd like to leave feedback, comments, or questions, you can call the voicemail line at 206-203-2031. Or you can send me an email at feedback@getpublishedpodcast.com. Send me a friend request on Facebook or friend feed at Michael Plested, or follow me on Twitter at mplested. And before I let you go, I could really use some comments and ratings on iTunes too. I'd love to hear from you. Until next time, work hard, never give up, and maybe you too can get published. Thanks for listening.
Get Published is an Irreverent Muse production.